Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The progressive era in United States history is swept in by the likes of Theodore Roosevelt, the president, and his bully pulpit, a first and magnificent wave of investigative journalists, the so-called muckrakers, and wrapped up with an entirely different sort of president and man, Ohio's William Howard Taft. All three elements are brought to the fore in the new book by Doris Kearns Goodwin, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Doris Kearns Goodwin joins us by phone today to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
So it's a three-legged stool of a book, but which was your primary inspiration? Who did it start with?
Well, it started with Theodore Roosevelt. You know, I taught a seminar on him 4 decades ago, always been interested in that colorful, always energetic figure. But of course, like with everything else I've done with Lincoln or FDR, so many great books written about him alone that I knew I wanted to have my own angle into the story. So as I looked into his presidency further and realized that he had handpicked President Taft as his successor and then, of course, had run against him in 1912 and then found that they had become great friends and had long since written letters to one another before the break, I realized, gosh, that's the story I'd like to tell. And then when I tried to figure out what made Teddy so successful and why did Taft, despite being a really amiable, good man, and in some ways carrying out Roosevelt's legacy, fall short as a public leader, I realized it was their relationships with the press. One was so at ease with it. Taft, more as a judicial guy, was never at ease with the press. So that's how the journalists come into this story.
I'm talking with Doris Kearns Goodwin, biographer, historian, political commentator, and author of The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. The parallels, Doris, especially political, between the progressive era and the current times are hard to miss. It makes the book all the more timely and interesting. It was a great time of dissension in the Republican Party, but in an entirely different way.
That is correct. I mean, obviously, now we have the dissension between the Tea Party and the more mainstream Republican Party. At that time, it was the conservatives who were the majority party and the progressives who were gradually building strength and wanted to move the Republican Party in a far more progressive direction. You know, the interesting thing is it takes me so long to write these books that somehow history seems to cycle back.
I was going to ask you.
I mean, and I think there is a reason why the gap between the rich and the poor, the ordinary people feeling struggled, businesses becoming larger and larger entities, why that seems to have happened today and happened at the turn of the 20th century, because what brought it on in 1900 was, of course, the Industrial Revolution, which fundamentally altered the economy of the nation and created what we know now as the Gilded Age. And we've had the Digital Revolution in these last years, which again have altered the economy, creating these billionaires, and yet still life for ordinary people being tough. So it does feel like you can learn, I hope, from history by looking back at the past and seeing how other people struggled in a time that had some similarities. The progressive movement was the answer to the Gilded Age back then.
I guess I kind of wonder, aren't you glad you waited?
there was no choice because I took so long. I mean, people teased me about Lincoln that somehow, did I know that Obama was going to become president? Did I know that he would appoint Hillary as his Secretary of State, just as Lincoln had appointed his chief rival, Seward? And of course, there was no way I knew any of that. It just happened to roll around after I took so long. So it was great.
It's hard to imagine the scene you paint at the beginning of the book about Roosevelt's homecoming after more than a year in Africa and several months in Europe. The homecoming was absolutely amazing. It was like the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade to the power of 100. The nation was enthralled with its former president. And I that's something I learned.
Now, I think one of the things that it was important to recreate was how connected the American people felt to Roosevelt. I mean, they called him Teddy. I mean, there was a sense of intimacy. And I think it was in part because he was so colorful. He was so interested in so many things. He's a rough rider, but he's also an aristocrat. He writes books. He reads books. He's a birder. He's a wild game hunter. He boxes. He wrestles. You know, there was no activity that didn't interest him. And he read books all the time, every moment he could snatch a moment. But more than that, he made it his business to connect to the people. He took these really long train trips year after year around the country, a whistle-stop tour. He'd stop at village stations. He knew how to talk to ordinary people in shorthand language, a master at slogans, the square deal, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick. He even gave Maxwell House the slogan, good to the very last drop. He was perfect at reducing tough things to simple language. And then he just gave himself to the people. He'd stand at those village stations accepting their ridiculous gifts. They would give him bears and horned toads and lizards. And then he would wave at them as he went by into the little village crossings, waving and waving and hoping that somebody would be glad to see their president go by. So all of that made him, probably in an era where you saw your president more than ever before, the most popular president we had probably had.
He chose not to run for another term.
That was a bad decision on his part.
Why did he do that? Because he's one of those people, and you can't say this about Taft, and we'll get to him, but he loved being president.
Absolutely. No, I think he loved, you know, his daughter Alice teased that he loved being the center of attention.
Hmm.
It was his strength and his weakness. I mean, he would want to be the bride at the wedding, the corpse at the funeral, and the baby at the baptism. And he just loved exercising his talent in a more serious way. He just knew that he was meant to be president. But at that moment of his victory in 1904, he had become president, of course, when McKinley was killed in September of 1901. So he'd served 3.5 years. Then he won his own 4-year term. And he gave the statement that the two-term tradition was a wise tradition, so he would not run in 1908, though he later said he would have cut out his tongue or cut his hand off at the wrist to have not made that statement. And that's, of course, when he handpicked Taft as his successor. But I think he would have clearly won in 1908 had he decided to run again.
So his regret wasn't at first associated with Taft and his disappointment in Taft's...
Oh, no. Right away, I think he did. No,
mm-hmm.
I think he regretted it even as his own term was coming to an end. There are letters when he wrote to people while he's still feeling that Taft is the best man to protect my legacy, just saying, if anyone thinks that this is a happy thing for me leaving, it's not so. I've loved this job. And that's why he made this trip to Africa. He said, I know I have to be busy and excited because otherwise I'm going to feel the letdown so much. So he goes on that wild game hunt to Africa for that year, partly to give Taft space so he's not there, but partly because he knows he has to keep himself busy so he won't miss it so much.
If you're listening and have a question or comment for my guest, Doris Kearns Goodwin, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said that, though, the story the press failed to cover that day of Roosevelt's return was his response to the major political issue of the day, the split between progressive Republicans and Taft. By then, had the split been that obvious?
It was to the journalists obvious at that
okay.
time. I mean, what had happened is in the year of Teddy's absence, Taft had really tried to bring about the legislation that was the next legislation on the agenda. In fact, he was brave enough to go for tariff reform, which Teddy never had done, which Teddy understood would split the Republican Party because the Eastern manufacturers wanted to keep high tariffs, the Western farmers wanted them low, and Taft goes bravely into that breach. He does produce tariff reform, but it's compromised, and the progressive field was compromised too much. And then he tries to get legislation to legitimize Teddy's conservation withdrawals of lands for public parks. And he was right, probably, that it needed laws versus executive actions that Teddy had taken. But in the course of waiting for that to take place, the conservationists felt he had been going back on them. So they tell Teddy as soon as he's coming back from Africa, your guy has gone in with the old guard, which wasn't really true. But once that perception was there, the progressives wanted Teddy to carry their banner.
Why didn't Roosevelt reach out to Taft more at that time? They could have surreptitiously, couldn't they, and had talked things through more, but he separated himself.
Yeah, it's really a mystery to me. I mean, here these two men had been so close.
Yeah.
I mean, the 400 letters they'd exchanged before, they'd been friends since they were in their early 30s, and Taft had really, Teddy rather, had been his campaign manager. You know, he gave him advice every step along the way. He was radiant when Taft was made victorious. And all I can think, there were a series of missteps. I mean, Taft had written a letter to Teddy when he left for Europe, and somehow Teddy never answered it, and Taft was hurt, and then Taft felt, I can't write him again because it's not dignified for me to do so. Teddy actually had written him back, and somehow the letter never got to Taft. So little things created enmity. And also, while Teddy was in Africa, he felt that Taft hadn't had Edith to the White House as often as he should have because she had remained home. But in fact, Taft's wife, Nellie, had had this devastating stroke, and the public hadn't been aware how devastating it was. She could never speak in connected language again. So So that's one of the reasons why he wasn't having these social functions. So that couldn't be fully known. That's the sadness of it. You just feel like if I could have early on put the two of them together and Taft could have explained what had happened, maybe it would not have led to this terrible rupture, which ended up being heartbreaking for both men. Then, of course, both of them are going to lose the election when they run against each other.
They could not have been more different. They were both had relatively privileged upbringings, but Taft was just one generation away from a lot less. How did they get to be friends? Not that opposites don't attract all the time and people aren't friends with people unlike themselves, but they were very different.
Well, I think what drew them together at the beginning, when they were young Solicitor General on Taft's part and Civil Service Commissioner on Teddy's part in Washington, they lived near each other, they had kids the same age, but more importantly, they both were like new reformers. They both were against the corruption of the age, the political bosses of the time. Both their fathers had been interested in social justice, and so there weren't that many people in politics from their class that really cared about changing things. So there they changed things. And then I do think it was partly opposites attracting. I mean, Teddy said of Taft, he envied Taft's personality because people loved him at first sight, and he was the most lovable person he'd ever met. Taft was indeed amiable with a great smile, very kind, very gentle. And Teddy said about himself, it takes longer for people to cotton on to me. And then Taft would say of Teddy that he so respected his fighting ability, his rhetoric, his ability to give speeches, to prepare things way ahead of time, because he was a procrastinator. And then somehow they just became these friends. And then more importantly, when Taft became part of Teddy's cabinet, he did a great job. I mean, he was the central figure in the cabinet, and Teddy relied on him when he went away, which he did often on these train trips and hunting trips. He was acting president, actually, when Teddy went away. At one point, somebody said, What are people going to do when you're gone? He said, don't worry, I've left Taft sitting on the lid. And then, of course, cartoons, this big Taft sitting on the lid of all the problems in the country.
He was his surrogate. He worked with him for years. It surprised me that Roosevelt didn't understand why Taft's personality wouldn't translate into a smooth transition or a continuation of the Roosevelt administration.
You're so right. I mean, you know, it's one of those questions about succession, you know, which business leaders have to think about, too. I mean, in every respect, Taft had been the perfect subordinate, the number two person in every position he had. He gave credit to others. He would disagree with his superiors but not make it public. You know, he was the perfect, you know, amiable person to work with at every step along the way. But he should have seen, because it was very evident, that Taft really didn't like politics. He had never really wanted to be in it. He only wanted to be a judge from the time he was young. He had gone into it in part because his wife Nellie loved politics, and he was good at it as long as he had somebody above him. But there were moments when Teddy should have seen that when he had to make speeches, he waited till the last minute. And then actually when he was out on the campaign trail as Teddy's surrogate, it was okay because he was talking about Teddy, mm-hmm. not himself. You know, but then there were clues you should have seen that unless a person loves the rough and tumble of politics, and in fact Taft's mother said to him, you'll be miserable. You know, the malice of politics is not for you. Teddy's a fighter. He loves it. You won't.
And sure enough, even within the first year he held office, he was already regretting it.
I think that's right. I mean, the real question is, would it have made a difference if Nellie Taft, his wife, had not had the stroke she had 2 months into the presidency?
Right.
Because, you know, we tend to forget how private lives affect public leadership. He loved this woman so much. She loved politics. She was really good at it. When he said he felt like a fish out of water when he first became president, but then pointed to Nellie, there's the politician in the family. And she was very astute. She would go over his speeches with him, his strategy with him. And then when she had her stroke 2 months into his presidency, she was never able to really speak in connected language again. And a young woman at the time.
Right, but 47, right?
It's so sad to think about. Would it have made a difference? I'm not sure it would have made a total difference, but clearly the amount of time he spent trying to make her learn how to speak again. She could be learning to say glad to be with you or happy to see you, so she could be part of the administration and stand on reception lines. And people knew she'd had a stroke, but not the devastation of the stroke in the way it was.
My guest is Doris Kearns Goodwin, author of a new book, many books, including her latest. It's called The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Lots to talk about. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call. 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Doris Kearns Goodwin, biographer, historian, political commentator, author of many books, including her latest. It's called The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. If you have a question or comment about that, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Before we move on, let's just take an email from Bob in Westerville, who asks a good question, and maybe we haven't gotten to it clearly yet, but what counts as a progressive then and now? How do you make the distinction, Doris?
Oh, it's a really good question. I mean, I think what they would say at the time was that a progressive was willing to say that the problems of society and the economic situation could be handled by government, that government had to step in as a power, in some cases to regulate, in some cases to break up big monopolies, whereas the decades before the progressive era, the laissez-faire philosophy was so strong that people felt government had no reason to be in any way involved in the economy. So I think that's what it, so it might be workers' compensation, it might be, you know, something dealing with the unions, or it might be working conditions in factories or diseased meat packing plants, or it might be fake medicines, all of which were on an unregulated market. So they took the beginning steps to have government involved. So I guess to some extent, if we're still arguing about the role of government today, even though it's become much more involved in our life ever since the New Deal in the 1960s, it still is the question of what role should government play. And it seems like progressives would argue that there are certain problems in the society that only the people as a whole can answer, rather than being left to the forays of the marketplace. And it's just that the bureaucracy has gotten so much bigger today that we think of government as so much deeper than it was at this time in 1906 and 7, when it was just making its very first steps into the public life.
Were these progressive issue debates just going on within the Republican Party? What were the Democrats doing?
Well, what happened in the Democratic Party, there was a wing of the Democratic Party that was populist, which populist progressives somewhat merged at a certain time. But the Democratic Party had its strength in the South at that time. And the South was obviously against federal action because of states' rights having to protect their concerns about the black Americans in the South and any kind of civil rights stuff that might come through. So that even though there was this populist wing in state actions, they didn't agree right away about the need for federal government action to do something. Finally, when Woodrow Wilson comes in, there's a beginning shift, and they do get the Federal Reserve passed, and they get a tariff passed, and they get a stronger antitrust. But it took a while for the progressives to merge between the Republican progressives and those populists in the Democratic Party.
Let's talk about Roosevelt and his relationship with the press, because a distinction between his relationship with the press and Taft's relationship with the press is a big part of the story. How did he come to appreciate the press in the first place?
Well, I think fundamentally it was because he was a writer, and so he appreciated good writing. And from the time he was even in the state legislature, as a young college graduate, he saw that political bosses had complete control over the state legislature, and they couldn't even get laws passed to regulate tenements or regulate cigar manufacturing places in tenement houses. The only way he was able to get that done was to mobilize the public, and you needed the press to do that. So very early on, he developed relationships with the state house reporters, later as governor once again with them, and then as president with these investigative journalists who were creating the exposés on Standard Oil or the railroads or the meatpacking plants that created stories that he could then use to tell the public something must be done about this. But I think what made the relationship work is that he not only respected them, but he understood that they had their own integrity, so they had to feel free to criticize him or else they would just appear as sycophants to him. And they did continually criticize him in print. He would argue with them about remedies, thinking they were impractical at times. My favorite story of that is when one of these journalists wrote a review of his Rough Riders book, and they said he made himself so much in the center of the action, he should have called it Alone in Cuba. Everybody's laughing in the whole country at him. What does he do? He writes a letter to the journalist saying, I regret to tell you that my wife and family are absolutely delighted with your review of my book. Now you owe me one. I've always wanted to meet you. I hope you come east next time. The journalist was in Chicago. Now that's the kind of thick skin you have to make this work.
Bill Keller of the New York Times, in writing about your book, described the relationship between Roosevelt and the press as more like symbiotic.
Well, I think there's something to that in the sense that they both got something from it. That the press got access to the president, and the stories that they told could then be multiplied a thousandfold by the bully pulpit the president provides. The reason Teddy defined the word bully pulpit, bully meaning grand or splendid, not meaning what it means today, and pulpit meaning that a president can affect the way people view issues in moral terms, good or bad, and make people want to do something about the problems of the society. So the press would create these stories that he could never have investigated on his own. He could then use them in his stories, and then they would give him proofs of his articles ahead of time, their articles. He would give them his messages ahead of time. And it does seem like it's right on the edge, but I think it worked. I think it worked for both sides.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Doris Kearns Goodwin, talking about her newest book. It's called The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. It really helped him that there was this also new era of journalism just exploding. I mean, these are some of the most brilliant journalists, as you point out, and I happen to agree, ever.
No, that's right. I mean, luckily, this one group of journalists, it's really shocking that they were in one place at one time. Lincoln Steffens, Ray Baker, William Allen White, and Ida Tarbell. Even now in journalist history, they would be considered among the most brilliant ever gathered in one place. And they had a mission to do good. I mean, they wanted to use the journalistic profession to make the country a better place. And they had a camaraderie with one another. They helped each other with articles. And much later in their life, looked back on this period as the happiest, most fulfilling time of their life when, as they said, they were believing they could change the country and make it a better place. So he was very lucky because that was sort of the age of the reporter. In the 19th century, the most famous journalists would be editors because newspapers were very partisan then. So you would only read your Republican editor or your Republican newspaper or your Whig newspaper or your Democratic newspaper. So finally now national newspapers have come in, and these people are part of national magazines and newspapers that their voices are being raised all around the country.
And they don't have a bone to pick with any particular party. They're into the issues.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. In fact, some of them, I mean, eventually Ray Baker voted for Woodrow Wilson and became, you know, a partisan of Wilson's. Lincoln Steffens almost moved towards socialism, you know, and Ida Tarbell kept whatever she was doing private. William Allen White was the one who stayed with Roosevelt and loved him, and that one was the most real intense friendship. But he was like a partisan. He was involved in Republican Party politics, which the others really weren't.
Was he the one that he got to know when he was a police commissioner?
That was Lincoln Steffens. Lincoln Steffens had been a police reporter in New York. So wisely, as soon as Roosevelt gets there as police commissioner, he seeks out two people, Lincoln Steffens, who was the police reporter, and Jacob Riis, who also was a police reporter but had studied poverty in New York and made a famous book with pictures taken of how bad the conditions were that the immigrants were living in. And the two of them served as really intelligence networks for him, and they would take these rambles at night from midnight to 4 a.m. with Roosevelt disguised, so he wore a slouch hat and a big coat, to see whether the policemen were doing their job on the beat or whether they were in a diner eating or with their girlfriend. And then if they were, he would pat them on the back, and if they weren't, they came to see him the next day. So that was the beginning of his understanding that no leader can really be a leader without getting outside the office and seeing what the people are feeling and thinking.
A lot of these writers, a lot of these journalists did depend on their editor, the founder of McClure's in particular, to do what they did. They were given an incredible amount of time and resources to achieve their goals. He was very, very important. Can you talk about him a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, he was an extraordinary figure. In fact, he became, these five people, the four journalists and McClure, have become part of the big cast of characters in the book. You know, he'd come from poverty in Ireland. His father had died. His mother came to the United States. He probably had a temperament we would diagnose today as manic depression. His energy level was only matched probably by Teddy Roosevelt, and he had brilliant ideas when he was in the middle of this manic thing, but then he'd have long periods of depression where he'd have to go into a sanitarium where, unfortunately, they thought the only cure for depression then was a milk-only diet for 3 weeks, and you'd sit in the hospital bed for 3 weeks with nothing but milk, hopefully replacing your bad blood. So obviously he never got better from that. But he was the one who foresaw the dream of a staff reporter system, which really hadn't happened on magazines before, where you'd pay your reporters for a couple years, even before they wrote a word, to do the research that would make the articles really impregnable and a generous expense accounts. And then they'd start these huge series on Standard Oil or the railroads that would run for a year, month after month after month. And they became, all of them became household words as a result of, in each case, it was his idea. Sadly, they later turn against him because his manicness threatens the health of the magazine, and they form another magazine. And I felt so sad. But at the end of their lives, they all get together on his birthday and celebrate the memory of this time. And that's where the word golden age of journalism comes from, that they saw it as their golden age, and he too.
Chris in Dublin, you're on the air with Doris Kearns Goodwin. Welcome, Chris.
Well, thank you. It's an honor. Apparently, there were forces back then that rewarded the best journalists because they seemed to be getting messages across. Whereas today, I see that, you know, in the past decade, the Knight Ridder News Service was the only one that questioned the existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and they shortly after went out of business. The LA Times, some years ago, won several Pulitzer Prizes for outstanding journalism, and the next year cut its news staff by maybe 40%. NPR listeners are the best informed, as we know, and yet they're cutting by 10%, whereas less journalism of less integrity is thriving. What are the what's the difference in the forces there?
Oh, it's a great question. I think it's a really important question to figure out, because without that kind of really fact-based investigative journalism, not partisan, but really worked on, that's the way the problems in the society get understood and then people motivated to do something about them. And the worry is that it may not be to the profit of these big companies. I mean, the bigger the company, the more they have to worry about their bottom line. And the amount of effort that McClure put into his journalists, even he eventually went bankrupt because it was hard to sustain the amount of salaries and the research and the expense accounts he was doing. But it's so essential. I mean, I know today there's ProPublica, which was designed for precisely this reason, hopefully to have some of the print journalists who had left these other newspapers have a forum where they could do their investigative reports, and they've won a series of awards. They then give their stories out to regular print media. But we need a lot more than that. And I think if I were thinking of philanthropists and what they might use their money for, in a country like ours, a democracy, the press is such an important figure. And I can't believe there might not be lots of journalists who would love to do what these people did. When you enter journalism, you've got to have a dream of a mission and a call like they did. And if there's some way to figure out the economics of it today, I think it would be absolutely essential for our moving forward as a country.
Thank you, Chris, for that call. Could the writers of McClure's have achieved what they did without the access they had to Roosevelt and his administration?
I think that
it was incredible. I mean, you should describe. I mean, they got to sit and watch him get be shaved every morning.
No, I think that's right. I mean, they had their own bully pulpit through their magazine, but they needed the much larger megaphone that he could provide by quoting their magazines and talking about the stories they did. And he did. He had them in there while he was being shaved. I can't even imagine the scene. Somebody wrote about it. It's a barber is sitting there shaving him at 1 o'clock, and he's talking to them and gesticulating, so the barber had to follow him almost around the chair. And then in the afternoon when he was signing mail, they'd be back in again. They came for lunch. They came for dinner. You know, he wanted to see proofs of their articles ahead of time, and then they helped him sometimes with the messages. So As I say, it was a really productive, and I think Bill Keller's absolutely right, symbiotic, you know, meaning that it was helpful on both sides for these dissimilar people to have come together.
And it couldn't have been, well, I'm not sure it would have been, couldn't have been worse for Taft, but in contrast, Taft, just on a personality level, must have been a huge disappointment to these people.
Well, the thing that's so sad is that when he was Secretary of War, Taft was open to the press.
Huh.
You know, when it wasn't him at stake, but explaining the policies of Roosevelt, he had always been the perfect subordinate leader, as long as he had somebody above him, so he could go out on the campaign trail and talk great about Roosevelt in 1904. The newspapermen used to like to come to his office as the Secretary of War. They called it to go tafting in the afternoon. But then once he became president and was in the political spotlight, he never was comfortable. I mean, he never had wanted to be in politics. He always wanted to be just that step below so he could carry out somebody else's job. He was very amiable. He later said he knew he'd been derelict in his relationships with the press. But I think as an old judge, he originally thought you make a decision and it explains itself. And then once the press got a little critical, he was more thin-skinned than Roosevelt. He turned away from them, wouldn't even read critical articles. And then you lose touch with the country when that happens. And I think that was really why he fell short. He had been able to get some legislation passed. He deserves more credit than we understand for having finally gotten a tariff reform bill through, even though it dissatisfied the progressives. It was a step forward. He got laws passed to put Teddy Roosevelt's conservation policies into laws instead of executive action. And tried to do, he certainly did never mean to betray Teddy's legacy, as Teddy later believed. He just didn't know how to be a public leader.
I guess, and to his wife and her struggles after the stroke, she probably would have been a great partner in the role of working with the press.
No question. I mean, all his life, Nellie had been the one to spur him forward, and she really did have very good political instincts. Even when he was the Governor General of the Philippines, you know, she opened the palace to Filipinos and all races alike, whereas the military had kept it strictly segregated. She conducted a sterilization campaign for milk, which saved tons of lives. When she became First Lady, she immediately announced she was going to be a public First Lady, in contrast to Edith Roosevelt, who said, you know, that the only time you should be in the newspaper is when you're married and when you're buried. And she had no real interviews with the press, no political opinions expressed. And Nellie said right away, I'm going to be a public personage. She started doing extraordinary things immediately. She got involved with working class women. She got involved with bringing the cherry trees to Washington, which she did, and then creating a public park where there'd be free concerts and mixing people in the White House just as she had in the Philippines and helping him. She helped him design a series of dinners those first 6 weeks for congressmen and Republicans, Democrats, progressives, and conservatives alike, many of whom hadn't been in the White House because they'd made Teddy mad. And then she has this devastating stroke. It really shadowed everything for him. I mean, we can't ever minimize what a private tragedy it was for him. She learned to walk again. She could read. She could write, but she could never speak and connect the sentences again. Something happened with the vocal part of her brain. He could finally train her to say glad to see you or happy to be here so she could stand on reception lines and feel a part of it, but never able to have this partner to talk to. It was extraordinarily sad for him.
We will continue our conversation with Doris Kearns Goodwin about her new book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Doris Kearns Goodwin, biographer, historian, political commentator, author of many books, including her latest, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and The Golden Age of Journalism. If you have a question or comment, you're welcome. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Howard and Sharon Township, you're on the air with Doris Kearns Goodwin. Welcome.
Hi. I was wondering if Doris could possibly comment on the relationship between Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge I, because Henry Cabot Lodge, the first, was the leading proponent in Congress when it came to going to war against Spain, and Roosevelt is closely related to the Spanish-American War also.
Oh, I'd be glad to. They became great friends from the time, I think it was in the 1880s, when Teddy had been in the state legislature and Henry Cabot Lodge was in Massachusetts. And I think originally their friendship was a literary one. They both read extensively. Henry Cabot Lodge wrote biographies that Teddy read. And they both were, even then, against the non-reform candidate for president. They lost, the political boss candidate won, and Teddy thought his political career was over. But they stayed friendly ever since then. In fact, the letters between them must run into the thousands. It's in several volumes of their printed letters, plus handwritten ones. As Teddy became more progressive, Lodge remained more of a conservative. They had been much more allied in the early days, but even in 1912, when Teddy called for, he was so frustrated, Teddy was, by the judicial decisions that were undoing regulations that had been passed by states to help women in the factories or help working conditions, that he called for the country to have a chance in a state to recall a judicial decision. And Henry Cabot Lodge thought that was going way too far, undoing the separation of powers. But even though they split on that issue, they still remained friends. And then, of course, much later, Henry Cabot Lodge is the main antagonist toward the League of Nations, and he and Wilson's fight and Wilson's inability to compromise meant we never did get the League of Nations. But Lodge had remained a senator from Massachusetts all that time. And then, of course, later his family stays in office for a long period of time.
Thanks, Howard, for that call. Let's move forward to 1912. What brought the rift between Roosevelt and Taft to the point where Roosevelt wanted to dislodge him?
Well, I think part of it was that Roosevelt just really wanted to be back in the presidency again. He had loved being president. He said, when you exercise your talents to the fullest and you feel you're doing worthy work, nothing can match it. And even though he tried to go to Africa for the year after leaving the presidency, nothing really felt as fulfilling as it had been, for he had loved being president. But then part of it legitimately was the progressives felt that Taft was not one of them, that he had sided too much with the old guard Republicans in Congress in order to get his legislation through. And the rift between the progressives and conservatives was so big by then that even though Taft sort of stood where Roosevelt had been in 1908, Roosevelt had moved further left, just as he had this rupture with Henry Cabot Lodge, so he did with Taft. And so the progressives felt they needed someone to carry their banner. They went to Roosevelt begging him to run, and he finally agreed to do so, I think both out of desire to be back in power again and thinking that the country was not being led forward fast enough by William Howard Taft. And the fight became brutal. I mean, they said things about each other I can't believe they really believed. I mean, Teddy called Taft a fathead with the brain of a guinea pig. He knew how smart Taft was. He had worked with him. He'd been his main advisor when Teddy's cabinet had Taft as the main person in it. And then Taft talked about Teddy as a danger to the Republic. If he won a third term, he'd won a fourth and a fifth. It was really heartbreaking to see. But I think maybe when they went against each other, they had to rationalize it, so they made each other into even more of an enemy than they truly believed.
Which is so common in politics these days.
I think that's exactly right. Instead of just being able to have a fight about the issues, you have to turn your adversary into an enemy, and then the press loves it. You know, I mean, at these gatherings when Teddy would be speaking against Taft and the audience is saying, hit him again, harder, like at a football game, and almost like a mass sporting event.
What did it do to the Republican Party to have them go at it like that in 1912?
Well, it obviously split the Republican Party. What happened is Teddy decided to contest the nomination at the Chicago Convention in 1912. Taft had control of the party, obviously. So in the states that didn't have direct primaries, which were most of the states then, the direct primary had just been introduced in part to give Teddy a chance. Taft won those convention votes. Teddy, wherever the primary was introduced, pretty much swept the landscape. And so they come in with a certain number of votes. But Taft did win the nomination, and Teddy then felt that he had been stolen, that the nomination had been stolen from him. So he stormed out of the convention and created the Bull Moose Party, the third party, to run against the Republican regular party. And almost from the beginning, they both had to realize, one of the Republicans said, the only question now is which corpse gets the most flowers, because neither are going to win against the Democrat if the Republican Party is split. And that's exactly what happened. Taft and Teddy together got more than 50% of the votes, but Woodrow Wilson won the election.
What about the relationship after the election?
Well, one of the things I really cared about was I didn't want to end it when they had this terrible rupture since they had been friends for so long.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to follow their relationship from 1912 until Teddy died in 1919. And at first, it still remained one of armed neutrality. Political allies tried to get them together, but it just was too raw still for it to work. But finally, in 1918, Teddy was in the hospital having an operation that Taft had once had. So he wrote him a sympathetic note. Teddy wrote back, sort of breaking the ice, but most importantly, about 8 months before Teddy died, Taft went to the Blackstone Hotel in Chicago. He was going up in the elevator, and the elevator operator told him that Roosevelt was in the dining room eating alone. So he said, well, take me downstairs right away. He went downstairs. There's 100 people dining there. He goes over to Roosevelt. They embrace one another, and Taft sits down. And the entire restaurant erupts in applause, knowing that this means they've gotten together, because people had followed this friendship that had been hurt for so long. And Taft later said he was so happy. He went to when he went to Teddy's funeral, he was invited as a private guest, and he said he was so happy that they had gotten together. It would have made him sad his whole life had they ended in a state of hostility. So I was so glad to find that episode, because it's a nice thing, because it was what really happened. And there was a reporter there, luckily, at the scene to record it in great detail.
It just reiterates or reinforces that feeling of what if with them.
Absolutely.
What if Roosevelt had stayed around and helped Taft get on his feet with the administration? What if?
Absolutely right. I mean, I think if Roosevelt had stayed around and not turned away from him, that it's possible then that at the end of Taft's administration, he really didn't necessarily want to be president again, but felt he had to defend his honor by running. If Teddy had said to him, I promise you, as he had already offered him three times before, a seat on the Supreme Court, which was really what Taft wanted, Teddy could have gone in to win in 1912. And then you think, my God, what difference would that have made in World War I? Because Teddy probably would have gotten us into that world earlier. Would that have made a difference? Would the war have ended more quickly, or would we have lost more soldiers? Taft might have gotten onto the Supreme Court much earlier. He finally gets on in 1921. The last decade of his life is the happiest of his life, when he's Chief Justice and gotten the job that he really wanted. No, you're absolutely right. I've often thought if they just had sat down, and this again, when you get to these people, when I was writing about Franklin and Eleanor, my kids used to kid me that they'd come and hear me in the room saying, Franklin, just be nicer to her. Or Eleanor, forget that affair he had so long ago. So, too, I would say to myself, come on, you two, just talk. Don't keep this rupture going, because it really hurt all of them. And it hurt the Republican Party and the progressive wing of the Republican Party particularly.
On the one hand, one of the reasons why it was hard for them to get back together again was the nature of communication and the time. On the other hand, the nature of communication at the time, letter writing, was a huge benefit to you. I can't even imagine how many letters you read.
Oh, there's no question. I don't think I could write a book about a present-day president, because the real gold in the research are letters, diaries, private journals. You feel like you're looking over the shoulder of the person who's writing a handwritten letter at the end of a day, where when it's the only means of communication, especially back in Lincoln's time, before telephone, it's the only way you can communicate with somebody you love or some friend who's away over a period of time. In the Lincoln thing, Seward, his Secretary of State, wrote letters almost every night to his wife, who was not in Washington. And that's how you get to know intimately the people you're trying to bring to life. And, you know, 200 years from now, they'll have so much more stuff about us. They'll see how we walk. They'll hear our voices. They'll see us in three dimension. Maybe there'll be emails saved. I don't know. But it won't be that intimate knowledge that comes from a handwritten letter that really explains how you're feeling as well as what you're thinking.
Your book, The Bully Pulpit, has been optioned, or at least tentatively optioned for a movie. And so it'll be your second book that's inspired a movie?
Well, the great thing about having worked with Spielberg and DreamWorks on the Lincoln movie was that I really became part of a team. I mean, you write a book, it's much more of a solitary enterprise. And then when the Lincoln thing began, I became friendly with Daniel Day-Lewis. They asked me to take him to Springfield to show him the Lincoln sites over a couple days period, you know, the house where he and Mary lived, the state house, and his law offices. And then I went down to the filming in Richmond. I worked with Tony Kushner reading the draft of his speech, and then went with them to all the award ceremonies. So I really felt like part of a team. And in the course of that, Steven Spielberg and I discussed what I was writing. And so he asked to see manuscript pages. So he was the first person, really, except for the publisher, to read parts of this book. And then eventually he read page proofs and eventually the book itself. And so he has indeed optioned the right for a movie or a miniseries. They have to figure out what they think would be better. There's a lot of characters which might make a miniseries better, but on the other hand, the Taft-Teddy thing has a certain kind of emotional character that might make it a movie. So it's fun to know I'll be working with that same team again.
Lincoln, you were pleased?
I was very pleased. I thought that it made Lincoln come alive in the way that I thought I knew him. He told stories. He was funny. He was sad. He was a political genius. He knew principles and yet knew how to compromise. It was the person, you know, we knew he walked with from one of his partners as if he were a laborer coming home at the end of a hard day, and that's the way Daniel walked. We knew he had a high-pitched voice, not from ever hearing him, but because somebody said he had a high-pitched voice, and he projected that voice. So I really felt I wasn't even watching a movie, that I was watching this man that I had lived with for 10 years just walking around the stage. I thought it was extraordinary.
I think, I don't know, I mean, it was a wonderful movie. My favorite scene, though, if you had to pick one, would be when he lays down next to his son, and his son kind of just naturally rolls up on his back. And
me too.
He picks him up.
I think I'm right in remembering that part of that had been written in the script, but I think part of it was Daniel, when the scene was being filmed, making it even more than it was, just spontaneously. So that's how close he felt to the character. And that relationship with Ted was a really strong one during that Lincoln presidency. Once Willie had died, the other son at 10 years old, and Mary became so depressed that she couldn't deal with the youngest son, Ted, Lincoln had to become mother and father for that little kid. And I thought that was one of the strongest parts of the whole movie, the relationship between those two.
So as the team, did you have any say in the casting? And if you did, who would you cast for Bully Pulpit?
No say in the casting. They know that so much better than me. I knew all along that they wanted Daniel as Lincoln, and I can't imagine anybody better than that. But I thought all the casting was terrific. I thought that Sally Field as Mary was perfect, and Thaddeus Stevens with Tommy Lee Jones. I mean, every single part really had the right person. So, you know, I will trust them once again. I keep teasing, if only Daniel could gain 100 pounds, he could be Teddy. If he could gain 150 pounds, he could be Dad.
Well, when you're reading a book, you visualize people in certain parts sometimes.
No, there's no, I mean, everybody keeps saying, of course, John Goodman, who's a wonderful actor and has Taft dimension. Mm-hmm. People talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman. So they'll figure this out as time goes by, I'm sure. First, they need to get, it's the beginning of a journey. First, there needs to be a script.
And it should be noted that less has been written about Taft overall than Roosevelt. And is Roosevelt what makes Taft of interest, or why has he been relegated to less stature as a subject for writing, do you think?
No, I think you're right that there are certain presidents who just attract public interest. And also, Roosevelt's presidency is the one that really began to put this square deal legislation onto the books. And he's just such an interesting figure. So people are, just like the people who were waiting in New York for him when he came home, were attracted by the magnetism of the man, so are biographers attracted by the magnetism of the man. And so there have been some good biographies about Taft. Had he been president in another era, he might have stood fine. But I'm glad to have had a chance to bring him to life again, too, because he deserves to be somebody that we know more about, other than that he was fat and other than that he lost the election in 12 and won it in 8. He deserves better than that.
We've spoken about Nellie several times, but you spent a great deal of time fleshing out the relationships between the two first ladies, Nellie Taft and Edith Roosevelt, and their spouses, far more than token women, and Edith far more than a token woman behind the success story.
No, always I think that's true. Biographers of the 19th century sometimes would hardly mention the wife of the president. They might call her Mrs. somebody or other, which is crazy from human life. You know that partnership makes a huge difference. In Edith's case, what Teddy needed more than anything was a home. a sanctuary and a safe place that he could go from all of his manic energy. And that's what she wanted. She just wanted to be a domestic wife and a mother and give him that home. And, of course, Nellie, as we've said, wanted to be a partner and gave him that sense of connection to politics that he wouldn't have had on his own. And then Ida Tarbell, you know, one of the other big figures in the book,
right,
makes the decision that she can never get married if she's going to have a career, prays to God at 14 that she never takes a husband so she can become the most famous journalist of her era. So these women had to make choices then that we may not have to make today, which shows that the women's movement has gone far. Even though family and work still is hard to balance, we can make those choices.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're so welcome. I really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, biographer, historian, political commentator, and author of many books, including her latest. It's called The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher and listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.